Good afternoon and happy Sabbath, brethren. Good to see you all. Glad to be getting some of this rain that we've been having. It's been quite dry. I know for my job, it's nice to be able to get for our projects to stay on schedule, but we also need rain, so glad to have it. All right, so today, when we look at the general trend of religious observance in Western nations, there's typically been a steady decline of religiosity that we see. But I've read multiple articles in the last couple of years that have noted something different happening lately. Particularly, that is, instead of continuing the decline of religious observance, there's been an uptick in religious observance among the Generation Z. Particularly, that uptick is particularly seen among denominations that are considered more traditional or orthodox, such as the Catholic or Orthodox churches. The reason cited for this uptick, particularly with these, is that they're considered more traditional, and that they're also more contrary to Western society with its science-based outlook. These denominations hold a rigid stance on truth, right and wrong, and openly embrace the supernatural. If we look back at history, before about 150 years ago, humanity understood and explained the world pretty much exclusively from a supernatural viewpoint. Only in the last 50 to 100 years has our society worked to condition us to reject that worldview in favor of a science-based outlook. Now, I'm not saying that the religions such as Catholicism are on the right path with their view of the supernatural and their treatment of it, but just because they may twist the supernatural world into something pagan that they worship, doesn't mean there isn't some truth there. Satan mixes truth with lies to sell his way and his lies, but we shouldn't throw out the truth just because we may disagree with someone that may believe it or worship it. A good example of this truth and lies being mixed is in Matthew, when Satan's tempting Jesus. In Matthew 4, Satan tempts him by misusing the truth of Scripture to tell his lies. In Matthew 4, verse 6, Satan says, "And he said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, He shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone.'" That scripture Satan uses is true, and we'll get into that more today, but it's up to us to discern the truth from the lies, to examine the scriptures for the truth about the supernatural while rejecting false beliefs and lies. With that in mind, I think we should make the effort to shift our mindset to be less dependent on the scientific certainty we see today that is definitely used and abused in our society today. Work more towards having a faith-focused outlook. So today, I'm going to take the time to examine some of the scriptures related to the supernatural that we see in the Bible. Because this area is so open to speculation, I want to keep this message grounded in what we specifically see from Scripture, particularly God's agents, whom we see described, his angels and their counterpoint, Satan and his demons. The idea behind looking into this is I hope to give you the tools to understand what is well-defined in Scripture about angels, but also to avoid placing our physical thoughts, desires, and expectations on these supernatural beings, and also to avoid being led astray by worldly teachings about them. So, to start off with, what are angels, and what are the responsibilities and duties we see them undertake in Scripture? The word we use for angel comes from the Greek word angelos, or angelos, which means messenger, envoy, or one who is sent. In Hebrew, the word is malak, also meaning messenger or ambassador. This role is played out throughout both testaments of the Bible, where these heavenly spirits bear messages to mankind on earth to execute God's purpose. To really understand them today, let's look at the roles and responsibilities that they fulfill. Turn to Matthew 28 to start off with today, and we'll start there. Matthew 28, and we'll read verses 1 through 6. Matthew 28, verse 1. Now, after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. His countenance was like lightning and his clothing as white as snow. And the guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. But the angel answered and said to the woman, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. For he is risen, as he said. Come, see the place where the Lord lay." After the resurrection, an angel was sent to bear the good news of the resurrection of Jesus Christ to the faithful. At this point in the morning, as the sun rose, Jesus had long been resurrected from the dead. So the angel wasn't there to assist with the resurrection or let Jesus out of the tomb. Instead, he was there to proclaim the message to the faithful women of his resurrection and let the women and disciples know, and let the women and disciples into the tomb to see the physical part of the message, the empty tomb. Now, on a quick but important tangent here, often in Scripture we see the term angel of the Lord. And think that that's an angel, one of God's messengers. But what we see in Scripture, whether that's an angel or actually God, can sometimes be fuzzy with that term. For example of this, turn to Judges 13. And we'll read an example that we see here and how fuzzy it can be. Here in Judges 13, we lead into Samson's backstory and his history. But instead today of focusing on Samson, we're going to look at the spiritual messenger. Judges 13, verse 2. "Now there was a certain man from Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord," there's that term, "appeared to the woman and said to her, 'Indeed now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink, and not to eat anything unclean, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. And no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb." From here, the wife tells Manoah of the angel, his message, and her experience. Manoah doesn't believe her, but he still fervently prays. So again, the message is sent. Skip down to verse 8. "Then Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, 'O my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born.' And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came to the woman again, as she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, 'Look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me.' So Manoah rose and followed his wife. When he came to the man, he said to him, 'Are you the man who spoke this to this woman?' And he said, 'I am.' Then the angel of the Lord again delivers his message, as well as instructions on how to rear their promised son, Samson." Now, this is where things get a bit fuzzy. Let's go on down to verse 15. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you, and we will prepare a young goat for you. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know he was an angel. He was the angel of the Lord. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name? When your words come to pass, we may honor you. And the angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? Verse 19. So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to the Lord. And he did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened as the flame went up towards heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. When the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die because we have seen God. So was this messenger an angel or was he God? The scripture seems to imply that it was God, but it doesn't explicitly state that. Like when God visited Abraham before judging Sodom and Gomorrah, where it does. But in these verses, what are some nudges that this was God rather than an angel? Well, in verse 11, when the angel of the Lord responds to Manoah's inquiry, the translators capitalized he. When it says, and he said, I am. Also, that I am could also be a subtle nudge that it was God because I am, or the self-existent one, is one of the names of God. Third, when Manoah asks the angel of the Lord for his name, he responds, why do you ask my name? See, it is wonderful. Wonderful is another of the names of God. Then finally, the way the angel of the Lord ascends in the flames of the offering is parallel imagery with Jesus ascending from the Mount of Olives after his crucifixion and resurrection. From these hints and their responses to the event, I personally lean towards believing that it was God, but it's not definitive. Another example of the ambiguity of the term angel of the Lord is in Exodus 3, when God spoke to Moses through the burning bush. In this scripture, there isn't much ambiguity as to who Moses is in the presence is, but the term angel of the Lord is used here too. Turn to Exodus 3, and we'll read verses 2 through 6. Exodus 3, verses 2 through 6. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off from your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. If Moses was in the presence of an angel, would the ground be holy, and would he have to remove his sandals? The angel of the Lord here explicitly states that he is the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then later he says, when Moses asked for his name, he says, you still say my name is I am, the name of God. Okay, finish with that tangent there. Let's get back to looking at what angels do and what their roles are. So the first role we'll talk about today is that of protector. The second one is messenger, second one is protector. The other role of angels as protectors and is protectors and guardians. Because this role isn't as direct as the role of messenger for us to see, the examples we see of this in Scripture are less direct. But the Scriptures do imply that they take on a role as protector, particularly to God, to those God has an interest in. For example, this Scripture in Matthew applies that children have angels watching over them. When Jesus rebukes his disciples for vying for status and greatness, in the midst of his correction to them, and he states this in Matthew 18, verse 10, it says, "Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven." Implies that there's angels around children watching over them. Now, let's turn back to Genesis 24, and we'll find another scripture that refers to God's angels protecting those he has interest in. Genesis 24. Here Abraham's servant has been sent on the errand to find a wife for Isaac. When he explains the errand to Laban, he includes this statement in his tale. Genesis 24, verse 39. "And I said to my master, 'Perhaps the women will not follow me.' But he said to me, 'The Lord before whom I walk will send his angel with you and prosper your way, and you shall take a wife for my son, for my family, and from my father's house.'" From Abraham's servant's account, he seems to describe angels as being sent to protect him along his travels. For another example, let's turn back to Psalms 91. Psalm 91. This psalm is about the protection the Lord provides to those who abide in his presence. In Psalm 91, verse 9, it states, "Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over you, to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone." According to this psalm, God gives his angels charge over those who abide in his ways, to protect and keep them from all evil that might befall them. In fact, if you recall back to the beginning of my message, this is the very scripture that Satan uses in the temptation of Christ that he twists in his second attempt to tempt Jesus when he tried to get him to throw himself down from the high place. While I mentioned that this role of protector is often not seen, sometimes God does choose to display his protection in a more obvious manner. For this, turn to 2 Kings. 2 Kings 6. Here, Syria is at war with Israel, and because of the word God has given Elisha, the Israelites have largely been able to thwart the attacks of the Syrians. With this in mind, the king of Syria, when he found out where Elisha was staying, sent an army to capture the city and Elisha. 2 Kings 6, and we'll read verses 14 through 17. 2 Kings 6, 14 through 17. "Therefore, he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God, Elisha, arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?' So he answered, 'Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them.' And Elisha prayed and said, 'Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see.' Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha." This, I think, is the best example of the full might that God is willing to use to protect his people. While in the physical realm, the situation looked hopeless to Elisha's servant. In fact, the Syrians were sorely outnumbered and trapped by the angels protecting Elisha and the city of Dothan. All right, the third role of angels is to be his eyes and ears, or his investigators slash witnesses. Although God has the ability to know everything, he does use his angels to investigate a matter further. For an example of this can be found in Genesis chapter 18. In Genesis 18, God is sitting down with Abraham to a meal, and when he gets up to leave, he reveals the full purpose of his errand. Genesis 18, verses 20 and 21. And the Lord said, "Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me, and if not, I will know." You'll notice at this point, God hasn't fully investigated the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. He only references that he has heard the outcry or the accusations against the cities. So, he is investigating the matter before he casts judgment. For today, we'll skip the discourse between Abraham and God about how many righteous people need to be in the cities to justify their mercy from judgment, and continue down to verse 33. Genesis 18:33, and it says, "So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place." Now, when we continue in chapter 19, we'll notice something. God's no longer physically present in the account. Those who continue on are his angels. Genesis 19, verse 1. "Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground." I suspect that God operates in this manner because he is a just God. He isn't just going to condemn these cities based on the accusations and hearsay against them, regardless of how awful those accusations may be. He sends his angels to investigate the matter further so that it isn't just the accuser's word against the judged. The angels were also there as witnesses to support the judgment executed on these cities. The scripture makes me think of the exhortation found near the end of Hebrews, where the writer giving the church instructions states this, Hebrews 13, verses 1 and 2, which says, "Let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some have unwittingly entertained angels." That was from Hebrews 13, 1 through 2, if you wanted to write that down. Now, this role as investigators leads into the next role of angels. That is, agents of God's judgment. After God has fully investigated a matter and issued judgment, angels can be the ones sometimes tasked with executing his judgment. One example we see of this happens after David sinned by taking a census of Israel to rely on their numbers rather than God. Turn to 2 Samuel 24, and we'll start in verse 10. 2 Samuel 24, verse 10. "And David's heart condemned him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, 'I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now I pray, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly.' For this, God gave David three punishments, of which David chose 3 days' plague, reasoning that God would be more merciful than their physical enemies." Continuing on in verse 15, it says, "So the Lord sent a plague upon Israel. From the morning till the appointed time, from Dan to Beersheba, 70,000 men of the people died. and when the angel stretched out his hand over Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the destruction and said to the angel who was destroying the people, "It is enough. Now restrain your hand." And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people and said, "Surely I have sinned and I have done wickedly, but these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray, be against me and against my father's house." Now, it's not clear how this plague functioned, but from the scripture here, the Lord sent an angel to bring plague upon the nation in judgment. When the plague reached Jerusalem, God restrained the angel, and at least David was able to see the angel of God's judgment. The events of the Israelites wandering in the desert are also described in Psalm 78, where angels are described as agents of judgment and destruction against the Israelites in their wanderings and Egypt before the Exodus. Turn to Psalm 78, and let's read verses 40 through 50. Psalm 78, verse 40. "How often they provoked him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Yes, again and again they tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power, the day when he redeemed them from the enemy, when he worked his signs in Egypt and his wonders in the field of Zoan. Turned their rivers into blood, and their streams that they could not drink. He sent swarms of flies among them, which devoured them, and frogs, which destroyed them. He also gave their crops to the caterpillar, and their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail, and their sycamore trees with frost. He also gave up their cattle to the hail, and their flocks to fiery lightning. He cast on them the fierceness of his anger, wrath, indignation, and trouble, by sending angels of destruction among them." Then in verse 50, it says, "He made a path for his anger. He did not spare their soul from death, but gave their life over to the plague." Now, it's not clear here whether the psalm is referring to sending angels as agents of destruction against Israel or the Egyptians. It could easily apply to either or both for their behavior. I'm not going to turn there today, but again, throughout Revelation, angels are the agents of God's judgment. Think of the bowls, trumpets, etc. As they're poured out or blown and proclaimed, it's done by his angels. So, the next, I lost count here, of roles of angels is to be God's attendants. In addition to being God's agents of destruction or judgment, they are also his attendants and engage in eternal worship and praise. Turn to Psalm 103. Whenever praise and worship of God is mentioned in Scripture, it's usually not limited to the physical realm. Praise and worship go on in the heavenly realm as well. And angels are some of these worshiping and praising him. Just like us, angels are created beings and should show respectful honor to their creator. Psalm 103, and we'll go through verses 19 through 21. "The Lord has established his throne in heaven, and his kingdom rules over all. Bless the Lord, you his angels, who excel in strength, who do his word, heeding the voice of his word. Bless the Lord, all you his hosts, and ministers of his who do his pleasure." Another example of this is found again back in Revelation 5. John in Revelation witnessed the throne room of God. If you'll turn there, we'll read through Revelation 5, verses 11 through 12. When he witnessed the throne room of God, among the events happening in the throne room was praise and worship of God. In this particular scripture, I think the worship may go beyond the regular worship and praise and thankfulness due to God, particularly because it occurs when God is about to initiate the final steps in his wonderful plan of salvation. Revelation 5, verse 11. And then I looked, John speaking here, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000, and thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing." In Revelation here, it mentions a variety of creatures in the throne room of God. From the description, it appears to function like the royal court of a king or monarch. As such, the ruler would have close personal attendants, such as a cupbearer or a trusted personal messenger. Turn to Luke 1, and we'll see an example of this. Now, I won't dig into much of this message, but we can see an example of these angels who seem to be in the close confidence of God. Luke 1, and we'll read verse 19. In Luke here, Gabriel has been sent with an important message to Zacharias, that he and his wife would soon bear a son who would proclaim the way of the Lord. In the midst of that conversation, Gabriel states this, Luke 1, 19. And the angel answered and said to him, "I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, and was sent to speak to you and bring you these glad tidings." So, by saying that he stands in the presence of God, and from other scriptures, it seems that he has a close personal proximity to God, maybe similar to one of these close attendants like a king or cupbearer might have. Okay, moving on to one more of the roles of angels, that is, caretakers or ministering spirits. Just as they can be agents of divine justice, angels also have the role of being caretaking or ministering servants. There are countless examples of angels caring for or helping people on God's behalf. Ministering spirit, which is part of the definition of the word angelos that I brought up at the beginning. One example of this is when we keep turning to is in Matthew 4, where Jesus is tempted by Satan. In verse 11, we read that after his fast of 40 days and 40 nights and the conclusion of his temptation, angels came and ministered to him. Matthew 4, verse 11, it says, "Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered to him." Now, this care wasn't just limited to Jesus Christ. Others called to God's service or his purpose have had angels care for them in their time of need, whenever divine intervention is needed. Turn to 1 Kings 19. 1 Kings 19. And we'll read about Elijah. After the miracles on Mount Carmel, and Elijah slaying the prophets of Baal, he fled from Jezebel's wrath into the wilderness seeking to die. We pick up the story in 1 Kings 19, verse 5. 1 Kings 19, verses 5 through 8. Then as he lay and slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." Then he looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came back the second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you." So he arose and ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. Just because Elijah was exhausted and depressed by his calling didn't mean that God was finished with him. He had more for him to do, so in this moment of hopelessness, God sent an angel to care and provide for him. Then, for the same duration of the time that Jesus fasted in the wilderness, Elijah was sustained by the care of that angel. In our moments of trial and weakness, sometimes we have to endure the trial to the end without God changing things or altering things for us. Elijah was not only cared for by the angel, but that care gave him the strength to press on for 40 days and 40 nights for the mission that God had for him. A similar situation happened in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus was about to face his trial and crucifixion. Luke 22, verse 43. In that moment where he struggled to go on, God sent an angel to assist him with the strength he would need to endure the coming trial. Luke 22, verse 43, there it says, "Then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him." The angel wasn't sent to do the work for Elijah or Jesus, but instead was sent to attend to them and give them the strength to do the work God intended for them. Now, I expect you're thinking, okay, those are the basics about them. But what about the more interesting things about angels, such as what they look like, what their names are, etc.? And also, you mentioned demons earlier. What about those? What about their history? Well, there's a lot more to talk about this topic, and that's enough for an entirely other message. So today I'm just working on laying the foundations for those topics, which are a bit more concrete, and we'll look at those other topics on another day.